The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. Thank you. It is clearly now the will of the Parliamentary Conservative Party that there should be a new leader of that party and therefore a new Prime Minister. And I've agreed with Sir Graham Brady, the chairman of our backbench MPs, that the process of choosing that new leader should begin now. And the timetable will be announced next week. And I've today appointed a cabinet to serve, as I will, until a new leader is in place.
Well, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, or the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. As you can see, it's a pretty big day in terms of UK news. So happy to be able to come to you live from our studio in Edstone, England. We're here 101.3 on the FM dial in the Edmond, Oklahoma area. On our website, of course, thetrumpet.com, where you can get the video stream with our broadcast partner on CRN Digital Talk Radio. As you can see, we are in our studio. Apologies that the video stream is not quite as clear as usual. We've sent all of our production staff to Jerusalem, so we don't really have anyone left back here to run the show. We have a good camera setup and things, so we thought the Zoom setup would look almost as good as when we just send it out from here. For whatever reason, the picture quality isn't quite as good. We'll try and improve that over the summer, try and have a look at why it's looking so much darker when using Zoom. It also means that I'm flying solo here in the day. No producer in the booth. They're controlling it all from Edmond. It feels a little bit like walking on a tightrope without a safety net, not having anyone there. But we have the production crew all there virtually watching over this, playing the clips, etc. I can even see a very small part of Sam, and I think over in the yes, and somebody else waving, probably Parker. On that Zoom call over in the States. But as I said, just a dramatic day, a dramatic few days in UK politics. I think it's about the craziest time, certainly feels about the craziest time I can remember. Over the last 48 hours, we've had, I think, 55, 56 now people resign from the government. The previous record number of people to resign from the government in 24 hours was set all the way back in the 1930s, and it was 6 people. Now we've completely torpedoed that record, and that all that culminated with Prime Minister Boris Johnson kind of resigning today, at least making very clear he would be going and that Britain has a new leader. I think we've got one more clip we can play for you from that resignation speech when he announced publicly, clearly to the nation that he would be going.
And to that new leader, I say, whoever he or she may be, I say, I will give you as much support as I can. And to you, the British public, I know that there will be many people who are relieved and perhaps quite a few who will also be disappointed.
So some interesting terminology there at the end of that. I think what made this week feel more dramatic was just how blindsided I was by it. It's amazing just the way this thing completely blew up after the weekend. It's kind of surprising. I'm surprised that this is the scandal that actually brought down the Prime Minister. It wasn't Partygate. It wasn't Wallpapergate, which was months ago now, where the Prime Minister or his wife spent way too much money replacing the wallpaper for number 10 Downing Street, and he had to get some dodgy donations to cover it. It wasn't because of lockdown. It wasn't because of COVID. It was because of so-called Pinchergate. This began last week. I would be surprised if most people in the UK even heard about Pinchergate until people started resigning. It was there's an MP named Chris Pincher. He's a homosexual. He pinched a couple of men on the backside. He sexually assaulted a couple of men at a private members club. And he was the deputy chief whip, basically a fairly senior member in the Conservative Party. He was forced to resign. It seemed like more bad news for the Johnson government. That was last week. Then kind of over the weekend, it emerged that, well, Pincher had been in trouble for this kind of thing before. So then all these questions were being asked, well, why did the prime minister put him in this kind of position of power over other people if he'd been in trouble for doing this before? And people were all, you know, asking the prime minister, well, does the prime minister not think sexual assault is particularly serious or something like that? So anyway, we got those kind of questions. The prime minister, Boris Johnson, he insisted, well, no, I knew absolutely nothing about Chris Pincher's past behavior. First I heard of it was when we had when he was forced to resign, completely in the dark. Then it turned out he had been informed in writing. And it was pretty provable that he did know about Mr. Pincher's past when he gave him the job, and he gave him the job regardless. And well, then that's the scandal. Definitely not Boris Johnson's biggest. I certainly didn't see that being the thing that brought him down. I wrote up Pincergate initially when I was putting together the news stack, the news reports for Mr. Flurry and sent that in. Last week, I didn't even bother including an update, I think, on Tuesday with some of the changes and how it was being accused of going up to Boris Johnson. There was just a lot of other news going on that day, kind of catching up after the July 4th weekend. So it didn't really seem quite important enough. Tuesday evening, kind of logged off, went home, didn't really look at the news much. Thought, well, I'll have a look at some of the headlines before I go to bed right at the end of the evening, and just kind of found, wow, okay, the whole government's exploded. We've got the Chancellor of the Exchequer has resigned, the Health Minister has resigned. In these COVID days, those are two of the most important members of the cabinet. They've all resigned. They're putting the pressure on the Prime Minister. And then yesterday just felt like nonstop drama. I told my wife after we saw this, I was like, okay, well, they'll have somebody lined up to resign at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning to kind of try and keep up the momentum, to make this feel like everybody's leaving the ship, because it was quite clearly a coordinated push to get rid of the prime minister. And sure enough, 8:30 the next day, you had somebody resign. It was the children's minister. At that point, I thought, okay, if he's in the clear, if the children's minister is the most senior person they could get to resign first thing in the morning to try and keep up the momentum, they obviously don't have any big names behind them. They didn't have many more big names behind them, but they had a lot of little names. And they kept those stringing out all throughout the day yesterday until we reached this point where you had 30, then 40, then 50 people resigning, and the pressure just kind of became irresistible, where, you know, to be prime minister, he has to govern. He has to be able to have people come and fill these cabinet positions. And nobody was taking the job. You had people who he appointed in office then resigning to try and get him to resign. I think it was the new education secretary. She was in place for 36 hours, maybe even less. She, you know, came in, her first thing that she did in the job was resign. So it became a very quick moving story. He clung on all day. It seemed like he was going to try and fight it out. There were talk of him saying, well, I'm not going to resign. I'm going to make you drag me out, kicking and screaming, basically. And then this morning we got the news. He's going to resign. And then he confirmed it with that speech that we played some clips from. So it will be no more Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He said a very big turnaround for the UK. Exactly what happens next is still uncertain. What the prime minister wants to happen is he wants to stick around as a caretaker prime minister. And for the summer, parliament goes on its recess in, I think it's just a couple of weeks. So he basically plans to stay on. Parliament will go into its recess. When it comes back, when you start to get into the autumn, well, then you start to get into party conference season. And so his thinking is, well, party conferences, those are good times to choose new leaders. So maybe we can have a new leader. Conservatives can choose a new leader September, and Boris Johnson would like to kind of stay in place as a caretaker all the way potentially until November, and then have his replacement come into office and take over from him. The pressure on him isn't over. I haven't, because we've been setting up for the show and things, I haven't checked the news in the last half an hour. There's still a lot of people saying, no, that's not good enough. We can't have you on as a caretaker prime minister. All of these people are resigning because they've got no confidence in you personally. So we want you to resign now. We want a new caretaker prime minister. We want, say, the deputy prime minister, I think that's Dominic Raab, to come in and run as caretaker prime minister. There's even talk of Theresa May coming back as that caretaker prime minister. But they're saying people are resigning not because of a policy disagreement, but because they don't believe you are capable of running the country or have the character to run the country. We want you out. And a caretaker is not acceptable. So I think we'll see over the next few days now whether he's able to stay along as a caretaker. I think the leader of the Labour Party, the main left-wing party, he's kind of put the boot in saying, well, he'll hold a vote of confidence in Boris Johnson in Parliament, and maybe Parliament, if enough Conservative rebels go against him, we'll boot him out. We will see. But I know, like I said, I was surprised that this is what brought him down. I mean, definitely a scandal, and it's, I mean, yeah, the whole story about him appointing somebody with this record is definitely not great. But I don't know, like, part of me is still baffled by this. All of those ministers that stood by him through lockdown, I mean, that's got to be the worst. That's thousands of times worse than what he's accused of here. Putting the entire country under house arrest, destroying liberties that have existed in this country for 1,000 years or more. They stood by him through, like I said, wallpaper gate, this other kind of ridiculous scandal. They stood by him through party gate, where he was caught partying himself and then lying about it to Parliament, where, you know, his government was fining teenagers £10,000 for having a few too many people over to their dorm rooms. These massive life-changing sums of money, all the while he was personally ignoring the rules and his entire government. They stood by him through that. And then this is kind of where they draw the line. It doesn't really make sense. I guess it's an accumulation of scandals. This is kind of the final straw. He promised, he was kind of given a last chance last time over Partygate, and he kind of promised he would get better. But I'm sure most people hadn't even heard of the Chris Pincher scandal until people started resigning on Tuesday night. But I do think it's interesting. It's fascinating to me that you had Naftali Bennett resign 2.5 weeks ago. So Israel's prime minister resigned. Another leader who at one time seemed kind of quite right-wing and genuinely very promising, who then turned around and betrayed his side and stabbed Netanyahu in the back, basically, to become prime minister. But you've got Israel, you've got the UK, both leaderless at the same time. And it could both these countries be about to get a new leader at the same time. Certainly, if Boris Johnson gets his way on that timescale, I think Israel is set to have their new election at the beginning of November. Britain could be having its prime minister the beginning of November. And the Bible makes very clear the fates of these nations are very closely tied together. Hosea 5 talks about, it makes some critical points about the fate of all of these different nations. If you look in Hosea 5 and verse 9, there's just this whole chapter, there's critical points to understanding world events. But Hosea 5 and verse 8 says, "Blow you the cornet in Gibeah and the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Bethaven after you, O Benjamin. Ephraim should be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be." So God says he has a message that goes out to the tribes of Israel, plural. You know, many people think that when the Bible talks about Israel, it's talking about the nation of Israel in the Middle East, the Jews. But they're just one tribe, the descendants of Judah. Maybe there's some other tribes like Benjamin kind of mixed in there, but God here is talking about all of the tribes. Among all the tribes of Israel, have I made known what shall surely be? And this is prophecy for this end time. Hosea makes that very clear. And he says, well, I've got a message to all the tribes of Israel. Well, where are they? This is a message to Judah in the Middle East, yes, but a message to a lot more than Judah. This verse alone tells us that these other tribes have to be playing a role. And this is just one scripture of a great many that talk about these other tribes. Prophecy also shows that God said he would make these other tribes, not just Judah, but these other tribes into great and powerful nations. Well, where are they? And Herbert W. Armstrong proves in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that Britain and America are also descended from those tribes of Israel. Britain or England is Ephraim, the United States is Manasseh. And so the fate of these three nations is closely tied together because they're all tribes of Israel. They're all subject to many of these same prophecies. And if you look in verse 12, it says, therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to that moth, and the house of Judah as rottenness. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article. I didn't actually write down the title. It's something like a mysterious prophecy, or Hosea's mysterious prophecy from 2013. I should have written that down. But he quotes this, and he says, well, the word rottenness should read like a worm or like maggots infesting open wounds. There's something very rotten spiritually about these three nations. They all need to see, and it goes right to the bone. It's that deep. Americans, Britons, and Jews have rejected God and his laws and lived their own way. Our nations are sick. So all three of these nations are rotten. God wanted to use all three of these nations powerfully. And all three of these nations have been disobeying him, and all three of these nations are afflicted with many of the same problems. It's a critical connection. Mr. Flurry writes, in America and Britain, deep spiritual rottenness appears in news headlines every day, yet these people don't see the problems or won't admit them. But if we look in verse 5, I'll just read Hosea 5 and verse 5, it says, the pride of Israel does testify to his face, and therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity, Judah also shall fall with them. So you've got Manasseh as one of the big superpowers of Israel, Ephraim, that's Britain singled out there, Judah shall fall with them. All of these nations fall together. Mr. Fire writes, so Ephraim is going to fall hard and fast in their iniquity. And the nations of Judah, or the modern day nation called Israel, and Manasseh, America, are going to fall with them. This is a prophecy for our time. Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah have never fallen together before. I mean, that's true if you're looking at this. If you're looking at this as purely history, it doesn't really make any sense. Ephraim and Manasseh, they fell a good 130 years or so before Judah fell anciently. But this is an end time prophecy. This is prophesying of another fall of these nations. That fall that happened the first time is just a type. And then in this modern prophecy, they all fall together. They all fall at the same time. Mr. Flurry writes, this verse speaks of a time where America, Britain, and Judah all fall together. That time is coming in the very near future. And we see right now all three of these nations going down together, even going down in the same way, where you have political chaos. You look in Israel in the Middle East, the nation of Judah, they've not been able to get a government together. They've had these repeated elections again and again and again. I think this will be the fifth time almost in a row they got in this government. I guess Naftali Bennett is nominally right-wing, but the balance of power in there is really pretty left-wing. In the UK, we've had political chaos and struggling to find any kind of leadership. There's no real kind of strong leaders around. America, well, I don't think I need to tell you about what's happening in America and just how fast that country is going down. But you know, all three are going down in similar ways. But then we also know that there is a turnaround coming. I think this is something that's interesting to think about. We can look at 2 Kings chapter 14, this prophecy that we talk about so much, that explains so much of what is happening in modern events, especially in Britain and America and Israel in the Middle East. But 2 Kings chapter 14 talks about this King Jeroboam, and the book of Amos, again, just like Hosea, it's full of all of these descriptions of a fall of biblical Israel that never happened anciently, because it's a book full of modern prophecy. And that book also talks about Jeroboam, a King Jeroboam II. So this ancient King Jeroboam II, he's just a type of a coming modern King Jeroboam II. And, well, 2 Kings 14 describes the reign of this king. And verse 26 says, "For the Eternal saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter, but there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash." Now, the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did, and his might, how he warred, how he recovered Damascus and Hamath, which belonged to Judah for Israel, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And so you'd had bitter affliction in all these nations. Jeroboam II, as we write about in our book, America Under Attack. Well, that's a type of Donald Trump. And God uses him. He's still, it says in verse 24, this Jeroboam II, he wasn't a righteous man. He still did all of this evil. He didn't turn the nation to God, but God still used the man. God still used him to bring a measure of peace and prosperity to Israel. And then Amos chapter 7 shows us that peace and prosperity allowed one last warning to go out. And we're seeing something very similar today. And in verse 28 there, it talks about this Jeroboam II, this type of Donald Trump, warring to recover something. How he recovered Damascus and Hamath, which belonged to Judah. So he wars and recovers something, but he's helping Judah out too. What he does, his actions, his warring have an effect on Judah too. They benefit Judah too. In America Under Attack, in this new America Under Attack, all the quotes are from the new booklet that I've got here. Mr. Floyd writes, "It appears Mr. Trump may have to recover some of Judah's freedom for God's church to even be able to deliver God's message to the cities of Judah." So there's a direct tie-in, and it's specific. The Bible specifically ties in, you know, Donald Trump warring, recovering this revival. You know, him coming back is benefiting Judah, benefiting this other nation of Israel. So, you know, we've already seen very clearly the decline of all three of these countries is tied together. We can see very clearly that the kind of revival in America and Judah, at least these two, is specifically tied together. That you have a revival affecting the others. Is it going to affect the UK too? It certainly seems like that would be probable, and maybe more than probable, that you'll have the UK kind of be a part or a revival there as well as you get Donald Trump back. Amos 7 and verse 8, I alluded to that. I'll just read that. And kind of with a slightly unfamiliar setup today, I neglected to grab my Bible, but thankfully I've got my laptop here so I can just pull the scriptures up on there. But it says, "And the Eternal said to me, Amos, what see you? And I said, a plumb line. And then said the Lord, behold, I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will not pass by them again anymore." So during the reign of this Jeroboam II, during this reign of this type of Donald Trump, well, God gets his message out for a last time. Mr. Flory writes in America Under Attack, "God passes by the last time to show three end-time nations of Israel, the United States, Britain, and the Jewish nation, how to solve their problems and to warn them of the consequences of their failure to do so." So Donald Trump comes back so that this message can go out one more time. And it goes out in all of these countries. It goes out again in Britain as well. So it's interesting. We see all this leadership turmoil in Israel, leadership turmoil in the UK. Is that a sign that we're about to have some big leadership change in the United States? I mean, regardless, Donald Trump is coming back, and we've got to have a powerful message that goes out still to all of these countries. We're going to have a powerful message that goes out to Israel, and we've got some of the students, we've got some of them over in Israel already to start digging, to start that archaeological excavation that really enables us to get a message of hope out to the people of Israel, the people of Judah, a message that says, behold your God. And we'll get a message out to Britain. We'll get a message out to America. And you can see how the radical left would shut that message down in all three of these countries. And God's going to use President Trump to stop that. There's certainly some exciting political developments, some big political developments here in the UK. I might come back to that a little more at the end. We'll take a quick break. When we get back, I will we'll talk about some other news from Europe this week as well and go over some other significant developments from this side of the pond. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. I appreciate that promo there. I meant to put in more of a plug for the America Under Attack booklet. You can, it mentioned in that ad there, you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. I'll just also mention you can give us a call on our free phone number, 1-866-930-3024. We don't have it back from the printers yet. I mean, if you don't have the internet, you can call us, request it, we'll get it sent out to you once we have it in stock ourselves. But if you want to get reading it now, you can go and do that on thetrumpet.com. I think all the stories today, it's just interesting to see how you need that book to understand all of these different countries as well, not just America. You know, that explains the basic fundamental spiritual realities behind the big political trends that you see today. And I did a quick search this morning. Britain is mentioned in America Under Attack 25 times. And even some of the other stories that we'll talk about from Europe, America Under Attack is the underpinning to understanding what's going on, no matter where you live. That book is essential for you to understand your world. Well, one of the big stories that's kind of gotten overshadowed now by all of the drama surrounding Prime Minister Boris Johnson there's been a lot of bad news, bad economic data coming out of Europe this week. I mean, that's been the story for the last 2 or 3 months, but the data this week was especially bad. Geopolitical Futures kind of summarized some of the latest, where Germany registered a trade deficit of nearly 1 billion euros. So that's just about 1.03 billion US dollars in May. That was the latest report from the Federal Statistics Office. They wrote that this is the first time since 1991 that Germany has recorded a monthly trade deficit. Now, Germany is usually, in the grand scheme of things, a trade deficit of 1 billion is not a very big deal. You know, it means that Germany imported more than it exported, and it imported about 1 billion more than it exported. I think for the UK, it's something like 50 billion a month. America, it would probably be even bigger than that. But the fact that Germany is now importing more than it's exporting, that's a huge deal. Germany's this exporting powerhouse normally. That's a major pillar of their economy. And I think about half their economy is derived, I believe it was. I should have pulled up. I wrote an article on this several years ago. But so much of their economy is derived from exports. So that when this falls, that's a real problem for them. The Euro Intelligence wrote, what this picture is telling us is that the German economy is massively vulnerable to the ongoing supply chain disruptions. And that's just one piece of the bad news this week. The other bit you might have spotted when we were talking about the trade deficits in dollars and euros, where the euro has reached the point where it's worth just about the same as the dollar. For quite a long time, the euro has been a bit stronger than a dollar. The euro, it dropped to $1.02 this week. It's a new 20-year low, and it looks like it's going to get parity with the dollar, maybe even below. Maybe you'll be able to buy more dollars with euros. Might be a good time if you live in America to go visit the European Union. This is from CNBC. The common currency of the eurozone has been in a constant decline as fears of a recession there intensify on the back of rising uncertainty about energy supplies to the bloc, with Russia threatening to further reduce gas supplies to Germany and the broader continent. So there's problems with the euro. And those problems look like they could well get worse. Europe kind of got through the euro crisis that hit in 2009 by repeatedly kicking the can down the road until things got a bit better. And they were also able to paper things over quite almost literally by printing money. And so they put off the day of reckoning. And that got them by while times are good. But now you've got that same old euro crisis that has been going for 15 years or so now, ready to come roaring right back. Europe's inflation is high. That was some more news this week, or this month at least. It remains high, and it's around 8 or 9%. And so Germany is especially worried about this. They want inflation brought under control. They don't want, they're a nation of savers, and they don't want their savings inflated away. But Italy is a nation of debtors. And the Italian government and a number of other governments have massive amounts of debt. So Germany is crying out for high interest rates to protect its savers from inflation and to bring that inflation under control. Meanwhile, though, high interest rates would bankrupt Italy. They wouldn't be able to pay the interest on the massive government debt, the large bank debts, personal debts. And so you're getting the same old problem of the euro crisis coming right on back. And some of those same indicators, like German government debt being considered so much safer than Italian or Greek government debt, they're coming back. And you've got the potential for a euro crisis really to take off. At the same time, then you bring in what Europe is going through with Russia's invasion of Ukraine that's happening on top of that. Sam sent me an article earlier this week from the Wall Street Journal, Germany to bail out energy supplies ahead of winter without Russian gas. And it was just talking about all of these different knock-on effects. All of these different knock-on industries from Russian gas. It's not just heating or people trying to keep their houses warm or generating electricity that's affected by these gas supplies. They certainly are heavily affected. But there's the fertilizer industry. This article quotes from a spokesman from, do I want to try and say this? I'll go for it. Stickerstoffwerke Pietzteritz GmbH. I'll find out from some of our Germans around here whether I butchered that or not. But he wrote, a shortage of gas would mean we would not be able to produce fertilizer, meaning that farmers would not be able to produce enough food. This would produce global prices up and create a shortage of foodstuffs. You've got the chemical giant BASF the Wall Street Journal writes that this could lead to the closure of the world's largest integrated chemical complex spanning some 200 plants. Such a shutdown would reverberate beyond the company, which sits at the beginning of most industrial supply chains from cars to toothpaste. A throttling of BASF's ammonia output, a key ingredient of fertilizers, it goes on to talk about that. Then you've got steel. ThyssenKrupp, for example, they're heavily reliant on gas for their blast furnaces to manufacture steel, and they can't easily switch those blast furnaces over to a different fuel. They can't. You can start up a coal power station, but they've got massive factories built around having a furnace that burns natural gas, and they can't make that furnace burn coal tomorrow. The head of the Ceramic Industry Association said in Germany, prosperity has been secured by a strong industry. If the engine splutters now, the consequences are going to be dramatic. And Spiegel wrote about those possible consequences. This week, they had an article, is Germany's prosperity at risk? Is Germany's prosperity at risk? And in this article, as they bring out, well, this is not just about German prosperity. If Germany's prosperity is at risk, well, then German politics is at risk. A lot of the start of their article, at least, it was all built around some discussions with Ulrich Schneider. He is the chief executive of the Paratisserschützer Gesamtverband, an association of German social movements. So they talked to him, and he was just talking about how poverty is getting much worse in Germany. Not since reunification have there been as many poor people in Germany. Never before have more children and elderly had to live in poverty in the country. The poverty rate has never risen as rapidly as it did from 2020 to 2021. Even among the employed, there is a growing number of people who don't have enough money for a life with social and cultural participation. Among the self-employed in particular, there's never been such a marked uptick. And the figures that Schneider cites are from 2021. Last year, inflation and rising energy prices played a much smaller role than they do now. What will the situation be this autumn when back payments for electricity and gas start to arrive in mailboxes around the country? Schneider believes that at the lower end of society, sheer desperation will then prevail. But he also believes that the usual supplementary bills for energy costs not covered by advance payments will hit home for parts of the middle class. But there are many experts, this article says, and politicians who paint a gloomy picture for Germany's near future. But they're not the only ones full of pessimism. And it goes on to talk about how Germans are saying they're extremely heavily or heavily burdened by their financial situation. More and more people going without holidays, going without clothes, even going without food as they struggle with inflation. But here's the kind of the meat of the article. It says, is the German model of prosperity in danger? There is much to suggest that the crisis could also create difficulties for the middle class here. Politicians are viewing the situation with great concern because the middle class is a pillar of support for the state and democracy with its political convictions, its commitment to work, and its desire for stability. If the middle class falters, so too could everything else. If the middle class falls apart, well, who knows what's going to happen to politics? Who knows what happens? You know, that's the kind of the conventions, the things that are normal. If the economy falls apart, well, they could fall apart too. No one knows what might happen if prosperity dwindles dramatically, this article states, and no one wants to know, which is why everything is being done to prevent that from happening. And it goes on. But this is something we've talked about quite a lot on this show. This is something that comes up repeatedly, that, you know, watch Germany. They can be, it's like Nicholas Frank said, well, Germany can be prosperous and democratic and peaceful, but watch how that changes as their prosperity is threatened. And especially as that threatening could come from abroad with a euro crisis, how hard Germans will fight to maintain that prosperity and the political transformation that that's going to bring. And we've played you clips from Mr. Armstrong where he talked about how a massive banking crisis and an economic crisis is going to be a trigger for what causes Europe to unite. And it could be a trigger for what causes Germany to change politically, what causes the strongman to come to power. I mean, there's political change going on in Britain and America. You could very well have political change going on in Germany, too. It's just over the last week or so, a person we've kept a very close eye on, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. He's been back in the public eye within Germany now. He's the former defense minister, but he's been out of politics for a long, long time. And he's now presenting a few documentaries, which to me, what was surprising is, okay, former politician presents a few documentaries. That barely seems like it's news. I mean, It caught our attention because we've been watching zu Guttenberg, because there are a lot of indications that show he could fulfill that strongman role within Germany, that he could be that next German strongman. But you would have thought that even within Germany, that would not be a big deal. There's plenty of people make documentaries. But it was all over the media. Big news in the media, even. You know, this wasn't kind of page 29 on the back pages. Everyone was covering. Zu Guttenberg is back. Zu Guttenberg is going to be producing these media documentaries. There's a real interest in him, which is just remarkable, given that he's been out of politics for about a decade now. There's still a lot of interest there. To me, it was that response by the media that was even more interesting than the fact that he's producing these documentaries. So we're starting to see him come into the public eye once again. So are we on the cusp of big political changes in Germany? It certainly seems like we could see something like that. Well, we have a free booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, that will tell you more about what we've been saying in Germany, like all of our material, you can get that by giving us a call on 1-866-930-3024. I also wanted to give you a bit of an update on the Dutch farms, where we've got a clip. We can show you. Mr. Flo played some of the clips on this earlier in the week. Those protests have kept on going. These Dutch farmers have been quite resourceful in trying to shut down food distribution centers, and they've been there's been lots of footage of supermarkets running out of food. As they do this, they've got the support of quite a large part of the population. But in this clip here, you can see, or at least hear, police firing live ammunition at these unarmed farmers. This is clip 3.
Nee joh, hey, wapens jongen, wapens. Hey, wolla, rij weg jongen, rij weg. Wapens is daar.
So they're getting shots fired at them now. They're responding with live ammunition. And it really is a mind-bogglingly stupid policy. But like we were saying all along, there's some intent behind this as well. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's not idiocy. This is design in a great many cases. So they want to reduce the amount of ammonia. They want to reduce the amount of nitrogen oxide that is emitted. And their solution is close farms. And it looks like they want to shut down about 30% of farms. Certainly, they want to get rid of 30% of livestock. Really, they want to reduce the fertilizer use as well. So they're just going to be shutting down these farms, shutting down these farmers. And like I said, it just seems insane. I mean, okay, shutting down a factory in your country for pollution reasons is kind of dumb enough, but I mean, maybe if you shut down a factory, people are just going to go without what that factory made. In reality, you know, somebody's going to build another factory in China that is even more polluting than the one you just closed to fulfill that demand. And then they'll also have to be transported halfway around the world to get to you. But okay, maybe shut down a factory in your country and people will go without. But if you shut down a farm, are people just going to go without food? I mean, of course not. That same food is going to be grown. You're going to have exactly the same amount of pollution. Again, probably more because it will then be grown in a country with fewer restrictions and things like that. But people are not going to just not eat. The Dutch government, they have some crazy plan to try and get. They want to replace a third of the meat with meat substitutes. So one third of the meat the Dutch are eating, they want them to start doing plant-based meat or whatever is in. I don't guess it's probably a lot of soy or something, but. They want people to go vegan, I guess. But you shut down all of your food, you just hurt your nation. You hurt national security. Food is essential for national security. You put your nation in a position where you can be besieged, when you can be starved from abroad, and you don't help the environment at all because that food is just going to get grown in another country. But what I think is interesting is the EU is just behind a lot of trying to shut down farming. I mean, EU membership was devastating to the UK's farming industry. You had their common agricultural policy, and a big part of that was paying farmers to not grow food. And there was a lot of devastating consequences to Britain's agricultural industry. And then even Australia, Spectator Australia, they had an article on how the Green EU starves the world. This is not just about the Netherlands, and the Netherlands, a lot of the reason why they're shutting down their farms is to meet EU climate goals. Now, the Dutch government, they're kind of applying those climate goals their own way, and they definitely could have more of a backbone. I don't want to kind of put all of the blame on the EU for what's happening in the Netherlands, because if the Dutch government wanted, they could stand up to the EU, they could ignore the climate goals like a lot of other countries do. They could not do this if they wanted to. But it's still something that's coming at an EU level. It's something that they're trying to push onto other countries. This article talks about the EU Trade Commissioner is hopeful that Australia is going to finally submit to a trade deal, one that will involve exposing Australia to sanctions tied to net zero emissions targets. So they want to force the same kind of targets that are causing the Netherlands to shut down their food industry, they want to force that onto Australia as well. They want to force it onto these other countries. Hey, we'll do a trade deal with you, but only if you agree to our climate standards. And our climate standards could mean you shutting down farms. This article says, in what world is we will only trade with you if you let us meddle in your nation acceptable? Would France, Germany, or any other EU nation allow Australia to boss them around on energy? Of course not. And Australia should get off its knees and tell them to take a hike. But it goes on to say, well, now Australia's got Prime Minister Albanese, this new Prime Minister. I spoke about him a few times ago when I was on the show. And it says, in his desperate bid to fit in with European leaders, will bow right down low, fumble with their robes, and gladly offer up Australian sovereignty just so that he can say he made a trade deal with the EU. The press will never question him on whether it's a good idea. So, well, then it goes on to say, telling a food producer that their produce won't be accepted unless they dismantle their energy sector and enforce expensive green tape on farmers is anti-competitive behavior, plain and simple. But you've got this environmentalism that's really this attack. And it's interesting how much of that is coming out of the European Union. But how much harm is being done by this? I mean, how much harm has been done already to the UK, to the US, because of environmental rules on oil and gas? And this is something, that's come up on this show quite a bit. The way that Joe Biden claims he's doing everything he can to give Americans cheap gas, while doing everything he can to stop Americans from drilling for oil and extracting gas. He's destroying the energy industry, and that's destroying the nation, or at least damaging it. I think it's fascinating now to see that same kind of attack move on to food. Okay, well, now we're going to use the environmental industry to shut down your farms. That's got the potential to be even more disruptive. I mean, a modern economy needs oil and gas to function. And yeah, there are a few quicker ways to destroy a modern economy than cutting it off from oil and gas and making it dependent upon other nations for oil and gas. But people, you know, more than just needing it for a modern economy to keep going, people need food to survive. It's an even more fundamental need. Look at the harm that's being done by forcing people to rely on food from other countries and potentially having food shortages. And again, it's just, how do you understand it? It gets right back to America under attack. If you want to understand farmers in the Netherlands, you need to understand America under attack. That book explains the spiritual reality behind what's going on. Mr. Flurry explained about this as well. He had a 2017 article with what the Paris Climate Change Agreement was really about. And he talks about just how much deception there is on these environmental subjects, how much kind of force there is. You know, it's just like it was with COVID. You step a toe out of line and you can find yourself cancelled and deplatformed. And, you know, there's a party line and you cannot deviate from it. And disagreements and even scientific arguments are not allowed. You have to agree with the party line. There's something very sinister about that. Mr. Flurry writes, environmental regulation gives significantly more power to bureaucrats. The governments most in favor of confronting climate change are the socialist, Marxist-type governments that want to control everything. Most of the money collected for climate change initiatives goes to these types of governments. Governments direct research money towards subsidies aiming to reinforce the notion that such regulation is necessary. He writes, efforts to reverse climate change may look like they spring from good intentions, but there is an evil spirit behind it. It is all tainted by deceit, intimidation, bullying, and autocratic tendencies. This is exactly the way a great evil spirit thinks. He wants control, and he will use any means to get it. He is very active in the world today, and the climate change controversy is evidence of this fact. This is obviously a provocative point to make, but you can prove it. Request a copy of a free copy of my booklet, America Under Attack, which explains this little understood reality. I mean, this is what it's all about. It's about blotting out Israel. And we talked about there being other tribes of Israel. The Netherlands is one of these tribes of Israel as well. You know, shutting down the fuel supply. Well, that's an attack on Israel. Well, now we're shutting down the food supply as well. And it's all about this attack on Israel, I don't know whether the EU is thinking this strategically about trying to shut down deliberately the food supplies of these other countries and to weaken them. But as Mr. Flurry brings out, there's certainly an evil spirit in this world that is thinking that way, that is actively working to bring down the nations of Israel. And that's the spiritual reality behind this attack. And he's certainly using the environmental movement to bring down Britain, America, the other nations of Israel. And you see this environmental attack now shifting into the food. I want to go back over some of the European Union's influence on shutting down Britain's food industry. And I say shifting into food. How many years has this been going on? Shutting down some of the food industry as a means to gain power. Well, I have 5 minutes left. I guess I'll try and blitz through a last segment. I wanted to talk a little bit about our book club this over here in the UK. We had our last book club meeting this week where we've been going through two very thick, two-volume biography of Horatio Nelson. It's a couple of very thick thick books, and we finished. We were talking about the final chapter on the Battle of Trafalgar on our Tuesday meeting. But one of the things that just stood out to me reading, I'd read it before, but reading back over for that book club, that last chapter there, is just how many real men there were, how many strong leaders there were. I mean, we tend to associate the Battle of Trafalgar with Horatio Nelson. Rightly so. He was right at the top. He was the leader. But there were probably hundreds, thousands of outstanding individuals serving in that fleet. It's amazing just how many strong examples there were. It kind of felt like if you were just to toss a stone into that fleet, you would hit an exceptional individual. And this really stood out watching British politics this week and kind of trying to think, well, where is there a strong leader? Who could we get to run the country that could fix things? That would be an improvement over Boris Johnson. And it's hard to find anyone. It's just such a massive, massive contrast. We talk a lot on this show about Isaiah chapter 3, where God says he'll take away the mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, and the ancient. And he says, I'll give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. And studying history, going back outside of the experiences in my lifetime, just really helped bring those verses home to me, you know, to contrast this with what it was like a couple of hundred years ago when this wasn't the case, and how dramatic that shortage, that famine of leadership is. And I'll just see how many different examples we can blitz through today. This kind of cracked me up. This was from 19-year-old William Rivers after the battle. He wrote, "Nothing is the matter of me with me. Only lost my leg, and that in a good cause." You know, people that were cheerful to serve their country. One of my favorite examples, someone brought this to my attention, I'd forgotten about this, in the book club, where Commander James Spratt, he single-handedly attacked a French fleet. And I mean single-handedly. He dived into the sea and swam to the French ship and climbed up the side and attacked it all by himself. He had did the whole cutlass in his mouth thing, climbed up the side, fought off. Eventually, his own ship kind of caught up, and then the men from his ship jumped on board too, and they won the day, and they took the ship. And there's all of these examples of just incredible bravery. Another story I liked was the relatively little Africa. I think it was like a 72-gun ship, maybe even a 64-gun, actually. The Africa missed a signal, took a wrong turn the day before, so it was kind of in completely the wrong place for the battle. Spent half the time desperately in this mad dash right across the enemy lines to get into the battle, and then makes a beeline for the biggest ship in the world, a ship easily twice her size, takes her on all by herself. It's just example after example after example. But you contrast that with where we are today. It really shows how we've lost leadership, and it really shows how we need to revive that. How hard we need to work to develop into these kind of leaders ourselves, to have what our nations are lacking. Well, that is about all that we do have time for. You can drop us an email if you want to get in touch with anything that we've talked about, td@thetrumpet.com. You can give us a call if you want any of the material, any of the literature that we've had offered on the show. That's 1-866-930 3024. Thank you very much for joining us on this Thursday, and we will see you same time tomorrow.